This is Age of Treason Radio. With your host, Tan Stoffel.
Yaki on Liberalism Part 3. Last time we talked about Yaki's idea of liberalism, and he had, this is from his book Imperium in Chapter 2, and we had gotten to a section that was titled Two Political Anthropologies, where he talked about the false premise of rationalism and liberalism by extension being the naturally good human nature. He had traced the idea complex liberalism. Interesting how he creates these compound words in a very German way. To the start of the middle of the 18th century, and he traced it to Locke via Rousseau, two very well-known philosophers. He said that liberalism is sensualistic, materialistic, and rationalistic. And I wanted to read a little bit here myself. The first time I read this years ago, I did not appreciate the depth of it. I did not appreciate the understanding of philosophy, and I interpreted it, what I was reading, in a layman's terms, basically. And it's not until this second, more detailed, more careful reading that I have come to appreciate just how deep it is. The ideas that Yaki is describing here and the context in which he's expressing these ideas. And it's very difficult to really appreciate because you have to have some understanding of these philosophers that he makes references to. And I'll provide some links where you can read a little bit about it yourself. I may sound foolish. A lot of what I've said so far in my analysis of Yaki, what I may say yet, may sound foolish to somebody who does have a deeper appreciation of Western philosophy than I have. I admit I'm a novice when it comes to philosophy. So I don't have that deep knowledge. And I'm learning it in order to better appreciate what Yaki's trying to express here. So there's in Encyclopedia Britannica, I found a definition for rationalism, since that's going to be an important topic in what I'm going to read tonight. It describes rationalism. It's a term from Western philosophy, and Yaki capitalizes the word rationalism, although not everybody does these days. But this is why, because he was talking about rationalism, specifically the idea complex in Western philosophy. The view that regards reason as the chief source and test of knowledge, holding that reality itself has an inherently logical structure. The article is much longer, gives more detail, but that's enough here. It also contrasts it with, it says, it's long been the rival of empiricism, which is the doctrine that all knowledge comes from and must be tested by sense experience. So you have this duality there, or these two competing sources of an understanding for knowledge, the one being human senses and the other being human thought and the human mind. And a little further on in that article, it says, in the debate between empiricism and rationalism, empiricists hold the simpler and more sweeping position, the claim that all knowledge of fact stems from perception. Rationalists, on the contrary, urge that some, though not all, knowledge arises through direct apprehension by the intellect. What the intellectual faculty apprehends is objects that transcend sense experience, universals and their relations. A universal is an abstraction, a characteristic that may reappear in various instances, the number 3, for example, or the triangularity that all triangles have in common. Though these cannot be seen, heard, or felt, rationalists point out that humans can plainly think about them and about their relations. I thought that was interesting. I see that as being a superset. Rationalism then is a superset of empiricism. Empiricism insists that its knowledge is only knowable through our perception, and we must experience it to really know it, whereas rationalism is the idea that you can augment, you can distill out patterns, and what this article refers to as a universal, which is interesting because I've always thought that one of the traits of liberalism is its universality. It's the idea that everyone is the same, everyone is part of us, we're all one big society. In my mind, I think of that as universality. And it's not quite the same as this meaning here, which means more abstraction. It's a general pattern. And the interesting thing about that too is that this is what Yockey was trying to do in his thoughts on these laws of political organisms that he's writing about in liberalism. He's generalizing. He's from the specific examples that he's heard of or read of or knows of, he's creating these abstractions. So in a sense, it's rationalism, even what he's doing. And although I think his point throughout is that there's more to existence, there's more to human beings than just reason. And he's very dismissive of the idea that everything can be encapsulated as within reason. So here, let's continue in chapter 2. Now we're on page 205 at this point. The leading 17th century political thinkers like Hobbes and Pufendorf looked upon the condition of, quote, nature, unquote, in which states existed as one of continual danger and risk, in which those engaged in action were driven by all the instincts and impulses of the beasts, hunger, fear, jealousy, rivalries of all kinds, desire. Hobbes observed that true enmity is possible only between men, that the friend-enemy disjunction is as much deeper between men than between animals, as the world of men is spiritually above the world of the beasts. I'll inject here to say that he mentions there the friend-enemy disjunction, and recall that that's how he defined political organisms, that the boundaries between political organisms are on these friend-enemy disjunctions, and that the law of totality, one of those two laws, had to do with basically suppressing these friend-enemy disjunctions that might arise within a single political organism. In order for the organism to survive, it must suppress these disjunctions if they occur within it. The point he's making here is the difference between men and animals. I would just note, he doesn't say it, but the main difference is language. And the fact that men have language and can communicate on a very sophisticated level, as opposed to animals who have pheromones, have grunts and high-pitched squeals. I mean, animals are able to communicate, but the thing that man has taken the communication to a whole nother level in writing it down and formalizing it into these languages with future tenses and past tenses, and very complex ideas can be represented. And the writing down is important too, because that allows us to maintain history and to pass that on to subsequent generations. It allows us to not only build a collective, as I think I said this at one point, maybe two installments ago, that, you know, wolves can make a wolf pack and organize, but there's a certain limit to how complicated, how big that organization can be, whereas human beings have much, much larger scale organization. And through communication and through the transmission of history and stories, myths, can communicate and organize across time even. So not just within a single place, but from generation to generation, we can create culture. I think also of the Jews, of course, and how they have that to the nth degree, and they sum it up in their aphorism, never forgive, never forget, that's their attitude. And we should never forget that they're always thinking that. Continuing with Yaki here. The two political anthropologies, and he's talking here about the one being that a naturally good posits a naturally good human nature, and the other, which just sees human nature as it is. So he had divided all politics basically into those two, one of those two presumptions. And he says that the two political anthropologies are illustrated in the story found in Carlyle of the conversation between Frederick the Great and Sulzer, in which Sulzer was explaining the new discovery of rationalism, that human nature was essentially good. Ach, mein lieber Sulzer, ihr könnt nicht diese verdammte Rasse, said Frederick. You don't know this damned race. The assumption of the goodness of human nature developed two main branches of theory. So now he's talking about the specific branch of based on goodness and rationalism, liberalism sprang out of, and he's saying that that branched into two separate branches too. One was anarchism. Anarchism is the result of radical acceptance of this assumption, goodness. Liberalism uses the assumption merely to weaken the state and make it subservient to, quote, society, unquote. Thomas Paine, an early liberal, expressed the idea in a formula that remains valid for liberalism today. Society is the result of our reasonably regulated needs. The state is the result of our vices. Anarchism is the more radical in proportion to the completeness of its acceptance of the human goodness assumption. The idea of, quote, balance of power, unquote, a technic of weakening the state, is liberal throughout. By this means the state is to be rendered subject to economics. It cannot be called a state theory, for it is a mere negative. That's a theme that he goes back to repeatedly, the idea that liberalism is a mere negative and that it's has to do with putting economics first and foremost. It does not deny the state completely, but it wants it decentralized and weakened. It does not want the state to be the organism. It does not want the state to be the center of gravity of the political organism. It prefers to think of the organism as, quote, society, unquote, a loose grouping of free and independent groups and individuals whose freedom finds its sole limitation with the customary criminal law. Thus, liberalism has no objection to individuals being more powerful than the state, being above the law. What liberalism dislikes is authority. The state, as the grandest symbol of authority, is hated. The two noble orders, as the symbol of authority, are likewise hated. So here, in this paragraph, he gets oddly anthropomorphizing. He's making liberalism out to be almost human in its desires and its wants and its motives. And that seems, I don't really like that myself, the way he describes it there. But the points he makes are interesting there, that he sees it as opposed to authority. It sees authority as the enemy, my word for it. But also that he sees society, and he writes society with sneer quotes around it, as a loose grouping of free independent groups and individuals. And I had not thought about it in those terms before, In fact, I had previously been working with the working definition of liberalism was philosophy of society. And I was using the term society without scare quotes, without the mocking the idea. Whereas Yaki seems to think that society is integrally tied up with liberalism. It is a liberal construct, or it's at least the definition of society is tied to the definition of liberalism. What society is and what liberalism are tied together. And that makes, you know, my idea of liberalism being a philosophy of society, whatever the dominant philosophy of society is, a sort of circular definition that makes it liberalism as a philosophy about the meaning of liberalism, in a way, in a sense. Just interesting. Whereas Yaki was very clear right where I started with him, talking about political organisms as opposed to mere societies, mere collections of individuals. He spoke of organisms. Anarchism, the radical denial of the state, of all organization, whatever, is an idea of genuine political force. It is anti-political in its theory, but by its intensity, it is political in the only way that politics can manifest itself. In other words, it can bring men into its service and range them against each other as enemies. During the 19th century, anarchism was a force to be reckoned with, although it was nearly always allied with some other movement. Particularly in the 19th and early 20th century Russia, was anarchism a powerful political reality. It was known there as nihilism. The local strength of anarchism in Russia was owing to its coincidental attractiveness for the tremendous anti-Western feeling under the thin Petrine crust. Petrine there refers to Peter I of Russia. To be anti-Western was to be against everything. Therefore, anti-Western Asiatic negativism adopted the Western theory of anarchism as its vehicle of expression. So that's just an aside there about anarchism. I don't want to get into anarchism. The way he portrays it, though, it's a purer assumption of the goodness of human nature. In that way, you could say it's a purer form of liberalism or purer expression of the same thing that liberalism is at heart. Liberalism, however, with its compromising, vague attitude, incapable of precise formulation, incapable also of rousing precise feelings, either affirmative or negative, is not an idea of political force. Its numerous devotees in the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries have taken part in practical politics only as the ally of other groups. It could not create an issue. It could not line up men as friends or enemies. Therefore, it was not a political idea, but only an idea about politics. Its followers had to be for or against other ideas as a means of expressing their liberalism. So this echoes, in my mind, what he said that I discussed the last time, how liberalism is not based on the friend-enemy disjunction. In fact, it seems to be above and beyond and at odds with the whole definition of political organisms according to friend-enemy disjunctions. And he notes that its liberalism is vague and imprecise, which was one of my what I thought was a difference between the way I saw it, liberalism, and the way he was describing it. He seemed to be describing liberalism in fairly concrete terms, whereas one of the characteristics that I wanted to capture and try to understand was why it had shifted over time. Continuing, anarchism was able to rouse men to sacrifice of life, not so liberalism. It is one thing to die to wipe out all order, all state. It is quite another to die in order to bring about a decentralization of state power. Liberalism is in essence non-political. It is outside of politics. It would like to have politics serve as the handmaid of economics and society. So now we move to a section that's actually titled Liberalism. And you can see here that I think that this the previous parts were necessary to even get to this point to understand what he has to say now about liberalism specifically. Liberalism is a most important byproduct of rationalism, and its origins and ideology must be clearly shown. The, quote, Enlightenment, unquote, period of Western history, which set in after the Counter-Reformation, laid more and more stress on intellect, reason, and logic as it developed. By the middle of the 18th century, this tendency produced rationalism. Rationalism regarded all spiritual values as its objects and proceeded to revalue them from the standpoint of, quote, reason, unquote. Inorganic logic is the faculty men have always used for solving problems of mathematics, engineering, transportation, physics, and in other non-valuing situations. Its insistence on identity and rejection of contradiction are practicable in material activity. They afford intellectual satisfaction, also in matters of purely abstract thought, like mathematics and logic, but if pursued far enough, they turn into mere techniques, simple assumptions whose only justification is empirical. The end of rationalism is pragmatism, the suicide of reason. It was that sentence right there at the end of that paragraph that really launched me off to try and understand the philosophical backdrop behind and the context of what Yaki is, the ideas that Yaki is playing with here. Playing is not the right word. The ideas that he's shaping and maneuvering here and calling upon his reader to have some sort of understanding of. And while you can read it without that understanding, and I can attest to that, I did it the first time, and even the second time through, I still, what I appreciate now is that I don't appreciate just how deep it goes. And you can't really, unless you do some serious study of philosophy and the history of philosophy. He makes it clear here that liberalism is an offshoot of rationalism and the Enlightenment. He sees it as materialism. To me, it seems like pragmatism, you know, just to use the layman's understanding of the word pragmatism, would be a check on pure reason. And so it would avert suicide. So that's what made me curious, you know, how does this make sense, what he said here, that the end of rationalism is pragmatism, the suicide of reason. You know, rationalism taken to its logical conclusion is called pragmatism, and both of those words are capitalized in his text here. The suicide of reason, also capitalized. So I went and I looked up pragmatism. I wanted to understand a little bit about that. And pragmatism, again, it's a term of philosophy, as you can see by its being capitalized. It's a school of philosophy, dominant in the United States in the first quarter of the 20th century, based on the principle that the usefulness, workability, and practicality of ideas, policies, and proposals are the criteria of their merit, which is the layman's understanding of that term, but it's the theory is much deeper than that. And to understand a little bit about the theory of pragmatism, the main proponent of it was a man named John Dewey, a real giant in philosophy and in social commentary in the United States. John Dewey was a leading proponent of the American school of thought known as pragmatism, a view that rejected the dualistic epistemology and metaphysics of modern philosophy in favor of a naturalistic approach that viewed knowledge as arising from an active adaptation of the human organism to its environment. So to translate that into English, plain English, basically the rivals of rationalism and empiricism were Dewey and others fused that and took a step beyond that dichotomy to create what they call pragmatism. They thought it was a combination of both, and which is strange because rationalism, at least from my simplistic understanding from what I've read so far, seems to already be a combination of both, that it's really empiricism that is idealistic and simplistic in its thinking. But just I take it as pragmatism being yet another wrinkle on top of rationalism. I hope that's not too profane for those of you who understand philosophy more deeply than I do. This is relevant. Back to Yaki now. He writes, this adaptation of reason to material problems causes all problems whatever to become mechanical when surveyed in, quote, the light of reason, unquote, without any mystical admixture of thought or tendency whatever. Descartes reasoned the animals into automata, robots, and a generation or so later, man himself was rationalized into an automaton, or equally, an animal. Organisms became problems in chemistry and physics, and superpersonal organism simply no longer existed, for they are not amenable to reason, not being visible or measurable. Newton provided the universe of stars with a non-spiritual self-regulating force. The next century removed the spirit from man, his history, and his affairs. I'll inject there to say this is why a few paragraphs back, Yaki took issue with the distinction between man and animals. And it's man that forms these political organisms because he has this friend, this high capacity for friend-enemy disjunction. Yaki continuing here. Reason detests the inexplicable, the mysterious, the half-light. In a practical problem in machinery or shipbuilding, one must feel that all the factors are under his knowledge and control. There must be nothing unpredictable or out of control. Rationalism, which is the feeling that everything is subject to and completely explicable by reason, consequently rejects everything not visible and calculable. If a thing actually cannot be calculated, reason merely says that the factors are so numerous and complicated that in a purely practical way, they render the calculation unfeasible, but do not make it theoretically impossible. Thus, reason also has its will to power. Whatever does not submit is pronounced recalcitrant or is simply denied existence. When it turned its gaze to history, rationalism saw the whole tendency as one toward reason. Man was, quote, emerging, unquote, during all those millennia. He was, quote, progressing, unquote, from barbarism and fanaticism to enlightenment, from, quote, superstition, unquote, to, quote, science, unquote, from violence to, quote, reason, from dogma to criticism, from darkness to light. No more invisible things, no more spirit, no more soul, no more God, no more church and state. The two poles of thought are, quote, the individual and, quote, humanity. Anything separating them is, quote, irrational, unquote. And that's a good note to end on there. That's a point I've made many times, not really seeing it the way he does, but these two poles, individuality and individualism on one side and humanism or humanity on the other pole. And in between is nationalism and racialism. And I've talked before about how those two in the middle of the spectrum are artificially depressed, are pushed down by the Jews, by Jewish influence. That's my opinion. Yaki, it seems, thinks it's liberalism that pushes down the middle of the spectrum there and forces people to think in terms of individual or humanity on the two ends.